Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips, in studio with Andy Roth. Mickey Huff is taking a well-earned day off. Today we will interview film producer Christina Lai Copeland and lawyer Wes Christian about the San Francisco Bay Area premiere of their new film, The Wall Street Conspiracy. Then we'll hear from Richard Becker, author of the publication The Rule of the Banks. During the second half of the show, we'll interview Jocelyn Beretta, Program Director of Global Exchange Fair Trade Shows and a speaker at this weekend's Green Festival. We'll round out the show with Brian DeShazer of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Well, welcome back. This is Peter Phillips with Andy Roth here and on the Project Censored Show on KPFA. This morning we're going to talk about a new film entitled The Wall Street Conspiracy, which will be premiering at the Grand Lake Theater this Monday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. And with us today is Wes Christian. He's a Houston attorney with the firm Christian Smith & Jewell. He's featured in the film The Wall Street Conspiracy. And his primary focus for the past 11 years has been suing Wall Street for fraud. He represents Salt Lake City-based Overstock.com in California litigation against alleged short sellers. We're hoping also to get on the line Christina Lee Copeland, who's the founder of Brown Saddle Films, the producer-director of the film. But, Wes, are you with us?
I am. Good to be here this morning.
Thank you very much. It was nice to see you in that film and hear what you've been up to. Wes, what is naked short selling, and why should we be worried about it?
You should be worried about it first because it impacts every citizen in this country who owns stock in their retirement account, their IRAs, any investments they have in stock, et cetera. So that's number one. What it is, what naked short selling is essentially where, and incidentally it is illegal, it's where somebody sells something that they don't own. So they sell stock that they don't own short. They take the buyer's hard-earned money and deliver the buyer nothing other than electronically, they deliver a wire that says you have this stock. But in fact, if you look at the what goes on in this country today, in part, a lot of stock, a lot of corporate bonds, that includes municipal bonds, corporate bonds, stock, derivatives, and even treasury bills are being sold electronically without being delivered. Our system is full of, according to officials in New York, in excess of $90 trillion of IOUs, which really means people have paid for something they didn't get. More simply stated, it is stealing at its base level.
Christina Lee Copeland, I think we have you on the line now.
I'm here. Good morning.
Welcome to the Morning Mix Project Censored Show. This is Andy Roth. You're, of course, the producer and director of the documentary film The Wall Street Conspiracy. I suppose the obvious follow-up question to what Wes Christian has just been explaining is, how is this possible today? If this is effectively stealing, how can it happen? What are the loopholes that make this possible?
Well, there's always going to be the bank robber. And now we have electronic technology, you know, in so many different ways. So with the stock market, it's gone to electronic. You know, they went away from paper, paper processing, and people are using that system because it's so fast, and people can't keep up with it. You know, the technology, and so they're just essentially, like, instead of going to the bank and robbing the bank of the money, they're gaming the system through the electronic way, and It's fascinating, I mean, to Wes and I and everybody involved. I mean, the SEC is trying to manage it. It is, a line item within the Dodd-Frank Act. I mean, we all now, you know, we have a new president, and he, you know, created the Dodd-Frank Act. You know, he wants to go forward with financial reform, but it's a really big to-do list. And I think the goal of the film is to bring this loophole to the public, like create an awareness, you know, because the average person really might not be following this particular problem. And if they know the magnitude of it, as Wes was saying, maybe they might care about it, you know, and support the film's subject, and that way Mr. Obama might know about it and might say, well, this needs to be on the top of the list versus, you know, at the bottom, you know, or coming up in years ahead of us. I mean, because everything within the Dodd-Frank Act, I mean, it, you know, they created it. And I remember when we were filming and they created it, they put it on the calendar for 2012, and that was many, many years ago. And you think, well, they lifted the ban. The problem still exists. They have rules, but they're not being enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mr. Christian is like trying so hard here to, you know, to do something about it. And so that's sort of where we're at.
So on the non-enforcement of these rules, you mentioned the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, and of course they have some of the oversight responsibility, but I think a very useful aspect of the film is to raise awareness around the DTCC, the Depository Trust Clearing Corporation. Now, insofar as we've got a loophole, we've got these phantom shares, what is the DTCC, and what role are they supposed to play, and how are they not fulfilling that role?
Yeah, the Depository Trust Corporation at its inception really came about in the late 60s, early 70s, which at its onset was a good idea. Simple versions, Wall Street used to sell stock certificates and physically exchange them daily or every other day. Well, as certificates began traded more and more and more, the higher volume of shares, the bean counters actually had to stop Wall Street on Wednesday or Thursday back in the 60s so they could catch the bookkeeping, could catch up, they could reconcile the accounts and start over. So they came up with a great idea, let's do it electronically. But as I say in the film, that means when you punch the button, you got to have the stock. So at its inception, the DTC, the Depository Trust Corporation, the key word there is trust, right? Is a good idea. That is, let's start a stock bank where all the stock's held, and that way we'll let you transfer it electronically with some stock behind it. Well, then what happened is in 1998, that all changed. It changed because the Depository Trust Corporation bought the National Securities Clearing Corporation, NSCC, which does nothing but loan stock. Okay? This is when all of Wall Street, in my opinion, changed. It changed Wall Street from wanting to build companies to wanting to short and kill companies. This is my belief. I'm told by Dr. Shapiro, Robert Shapiro, who's in the movie, that over half of the trades today on all exchanges are short sales, which basically is betting and hoping the stock goes down. So once they created that entity, then you saw a proliferation of this concept of these phantom shares. And that, sadly, the NSCC and the DTC are owned by the DTCC, which is the parent company that holds all this stock and now is the biggest stock lending entity in the United States and probably the world. Now, who polices that organization? Themselves. It's an SRO, a self-regulatory organization. Yes, the SEC has oversight, but they police themselves, which is preposterous. As I say in the movie, the fox is in the hen house eating all the eggs. And as a distinguished attorney general said in the movie, Harmon, he said, you know, if you deal with these people, you need to be very afraid because they're very powerful. The DTCC, just to put this in perspective for your listeners, clears, go to their website, $750 billion in transactions a year. So who can go up that kind of organization? Well, myself and a whole team of lawyers in about three different states have been trying for 12 years and are finally succeeding in getting them to settle some cases and are filing new cases. And, of course, are in this film and in other films we've been in and are trying to create this awareness that you guys are talking about. So that's who they are. They are the stock clearing arm for the United States and, for that matter, the world.
Wes, it seems like the Salt Lake City company Overstock that's featured in the film was really undermined, and their stock was oversold. It drove it down. Some people made money off of shorts on that. And that sounds like that's not the invisible hand anymore. That is a manipulation of the market. And the film certainly implies that this is a massive destructive process. Massive profit taking by some of the biggest venture capitalists and central banks in the world.
It for sure is. As I said earlier, some New York officials, specifically Cuomo's office, back when he was Attorney General, said it's over a $90 trillion fraud, okay? I don't know the basis of that number, but I've repeated that number simply because it was told to me. I can tell you that I believe it's even larger. I can tell you that it rigs the system. Imagine on a given day that a company only sells 1 million shares a day, and they put 2 million of phantom shares in, so now it sells 3 million a day. What do you think is going to happen to the price? It's going to go down. If you repeat that process enough, the stock goes to zero. This has been done, now listen to it, thousands of public companies in this country. That's a fact, okay? Thousands of public companies have been destroyed by this. This is still going on. Europe has banned it, most countries in Europe. Europe just passed a new law to make it transparent, because another problem here is that even though we were successful in getting Reg Sho passed in January of 2005, which helped a little bit expose this problem, at which time, incidentally, in January of 2005, there were thousands of companies on this list, but as the movie points out, that regulation requires the company who's having their shares counterfeited be published, not the counterfeiter who's creating the counterfeit shares. Well, Europe has a different tact, which America ought to listen up. Why? Because they banned naked short selling almost every country in the EU. And number two, now I've passed a new law that says you want to short, then it's going to be disclosed who you are. I don't care if you're an offshore company. It's going to disclose what your short is. And you better be delivering the shares, because we don't allow naked shorting. But that hasn't happened in the U.S. of A., which is unforgivable. It's financial terrorism on this country.
Christina, we have about 45 seconds left. I wonder if you mentioned that there's the possibility of some legislative reform down the pipeline here. Why aren't the people who are doing this in jail?
Well, we don't know. I mean, you know, that's the mystery question. We really don't know. And, you know, the SEC continues to have the same response, which is they don't have the budget, they don't have the manpower, and they don't have the technology to manage the problem. Now, Wes can tell you there's many companies that have been fined millions and millions of dollars they've done the fraud, they've been accused of the fraud, and they've paid the fine. So we don't know. I mean, that's sort of why the film matters. It's meaningful. People need to go out and see it. You know, that's why we're crossing the country doing this campaign, so that hopefully, you know, within the next 6 months, some sort of enforcement can take place and we can begin to see some changes.
I mean, the reality is, Andy or Peter, I don't know which one that was, you know, this fraud is so large and involves so many financial interests that, frankly, they can outmaneuver you in a lot of ways. Now, they can't when it gets to a trial by jury, which is what I do. So, fortunately, they have settled some of these cases, including the first Overstock case. So, the point to all this is that they pay these civil fines, as Christina said. They've been fined hundreds of times. Hundreds of millions of dollars in the aggregate, but who cares? It's a traffic fine. Somebody needs to go to jail. Go to Operation Bermuda Short. You're going to see that organized crime's in this. They've gone to jail, but isn't it interesting, as Patrick Byrne says in the film, nobody at Goldman or Merrill or these other companies that are being fined for this are going to jail?
Well, Wes and Christina, we really thank you for being on with us. Christina, we're sorry that the weather has prevented you from flying out to California for this debut, but the Grand Lake Theater is a magnificent theater in Oakland, built in 1920. You'll be featured there, The Wall Street Conspiracy, at 7:30 p.m. on Monday, and we encourage people to come and see this film as a benefit for KPFA and Project Censored. Christina, thank you very much for being on with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, this film is really, really important, and everyone in America should know about it, see it. If you can't go to the movie, go to the film's website, thewallstreetconspiracy.com. You can look at the trailer. We're going to have a petition up next week, so if people believe in the film's mission, you can just sign that, and we're going to take that forward, you know, to Congress, to the SEC within the next 6 months. You know, we want the film to speak for every American. You know, so this is the
okay. Thank you very much. We're going to take
you.
A quick music break right now, and have our next speaker, Richard Becker. Okay, up next we have Richard Becker as the West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. He's also the author of a new publication, The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Richard will be speaking after the showing of the Wall Street Conspiracy this Monday night about the power and abuses of the big banks. Richard, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Tell us about this new pamphlet that you have out called The Rule of the Banks.
Yeah, it's the full title of it is The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. And it's a short pamphlet or attempt to address these issues of the incredible criminality that's been going on Wall Street now for many years in a way that's understandable to people, because I know that a lot of the terminology that people hear, and because we're taught in many different ways that economics are not something for, you know, us to understand. But the pamphlet tries to address this in a way that's accessible and understandable. And one of the main points of it is to show how what we've seen in regard to Wall Street over the last period of time and the big banks demonstrates that while there is a myth of democracy, that the real rule of the real rulers in this country are the big bankers and the Wall Street investment firms, and that they are dominant. And there was a question raised with the last speaker, why aren't any of them in jail? And some of the documentation in the pamphlet points to the fact that top executives at banks like Wachovia and Countrywide Finance, which is now part of Bank of America, top executives there who were in charge of fraud resigned their positions because the people at the top would not carry through on any of the evidence that they were presenting, would not take any steps to stop the criminal actions that were going on. One of the most outstanding of those, Wachovia Bank, made an agreement with the Justice Department in 2010, agreeing to a settlement that they had laundered $378 billion in Mexican drug cartel money between 2004 and 2007. And they got off with a fine of $110 million, and not one of those executives spent one night in jail because of that. So this is, you know, this and others, the person in charge of fraud, the executive vice president in charge of fraud at Countrywide Finance, which at one time was the biggest mortgage lender, went on CBS last December, 60 Minutes, and said that she knew that there was systemic fraud and that she would talk to a grand jury, but she wouldn't talk to, she wouldn't give names to 60 Minutes. And yet the Justice Department has never questioned her, has never talked to her. And these are just, you know, some of the evidence of the collaboration between the government and the subservience of the government to these big banks and corporations, which should really outrage everyone.
And indeed, Richard, Andy Roth here, that Wachovia story is one of the stories that we bring forward in Censored 2013, the Wachovia money laundering story. It was our number 22 story of the top underreported stories of 2010 and 2011. So it's fantastic to see you also drawing attention to the scandal, the outrageous scandal of Wachovia's money laundering in your pamphlet, The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. You also talk in the pamphlet, in the publication, about in effect a double standard, and you compare, as you've noted, the lack of any convictions or sentencing for kingpins like Wachovia with Bernard Madoff, who ran the fake investment firm that he was aggressively prosecuted, convicted, and jailed. What's the difference? What's the double standard there?
Yeah, well, none of the top Wall Street executives have gone to jail. None of them, as far as I know, the top ones have been criminally indicted for these practices. Madoff was stealing from the rich. He was his Ponzi scheme. I mean, a lot of poor people, a lot of municipalities, workers suffered from this because their pension funds were invested with him. But the primary reason was that he was bilking the rich, and that's a no-no from the point of view of the legal system. But the others, with abundant evidence, this evidence, which has been made public, has not been picked up on, strangely enough, and it's not really anything strange, by the Justice Department or. And so there have not been criminal indictments. You get case after case after case of the government saying, and one of the most recent ones is accusing Bank of America in a civil action of blatant fraud. Well, if there's blatant fraud, wasn't the blatant fraud committed by some of the and with the knowledge of these top executives, and didn't they know that this was the source of the or at least part of the source of the fantastic profits they were making? Of course they did. And I think the other thing that goes along with this is that 2 months after the bailout, in December of 2008, an AP reporter named Matt Apuzzo called around to all of the 80-some banks that had received bailout money, and he asked them all, what have you done with the money? And every single one of them said something along the lines of this: we decline to say that, to state what we've done with it. We're declining to comment on your story. How can it be that the government could give $700 billion in money, our money, to these big banks and trillions of dollars in loan guarantees and not require them to have to report what they did with the money? Anyone who's ever gotten a government grant or knows of anyone getting a government grant knows you have to account for every penny. And yet in the biggest transfer of wealth ever by a government, there was no requirement of the banks. And I think that shows that the relationship, the real relationship, that it's the banks that rule over the government. The government rules over us, but the banks rule over the government.
We're talking with Richard Becker, author of The Myth of Democracy and the Role of the Banks. He'll be speaking Monday at the screening of the Wall Street conspiracy film about the power and abuses of the big banks. Part of what you're describing there, Richard, is in effect the privatization of profits and the socialization, in effect, of losses. And another aspect of the economy where we see that happening in truly ruthless fashion would be home foreclosures, now projected, as you note, to exceed 10 million home foreclosures. And you describe this in The Rule of the Banks as evidence of what you call it, the capitalist equation. What is the capitalist equation when it comes to homes and homelessness?
Well, this is, I think, one of the most outrageous and scandalous aspects of capitalism today, is that according to the government, according to government agencies, there are now more than 18 million vacant housing units in the United States. The government says that in any given year, 3.5 million people are completely homeless at some time. But we know that the figure is really much, much higher, that the people who have been foreclosed have moved in with other family members, with friends. They're hanging on by their fingertips to not be completely homeless. And yet, at the same time, we have this vast number of empty housing units in the country. But under capitalism, the property rights, the rights of property, come before the rights of people. And, of course, we want to turn that around. We believe housing should be a right for people, but it's not a right under the system right now. And the fact is that as more and more homes were foreclosed, more and more people became homeless. In other words, as more homes came onto the market, more people became homeless because many people had taken out loans and refinanced at the urging of the banks based on the notion that their house price, house value would increase as it had for several years. But then when it began to plunge, they were not able to refinance, particularly people who had subprime loans, adjustable rate mortgages, and so forth. When those balloon payments, the higher mortgage payments, kicked in, they could not pay them anymore. They could not refinance, and millions of people ended up going into foreclosure.
Yeah, Richard, we're almost out of time, but
sure.
We want to. I think what's really important here is that people really. It's hard to understand the magnitude that we're dealing with here. Barclays Bank was manipulating the LIBOR. trade rates. We know that in the billions and billions of dollars. We've seen impacts upon the pension funds here in California. We know about this, the prime mortgage decline, the housing value loss. I mean, working people and poor people have been impacted tremendously by this centralized banking process, privatized banking, that Ellen Brown says really cost is about 30 to 40% of the gross domestic product of the country is paying for interest to these central banks. So this is an amazing story that is really, it's kind of fuzzy for most people when you talk about the economics of it, that we should understand that. And that's why your pamphlet's so important and why we're really looking forward to your presentation Monday night after the film showing of the Wall Street conspiracy. Richard, do you have a last word to add in?
Yeah, if people can't make it to the film showing, if they'd like to get a copy of the pamphlet, you can go to liberationnews.org. That's all one long word, liberationnews.org. And I would just say, you know, all this stuff, all these products that they talk about, you know, the naked short selling derivatives, of what use is all that to humanity? It all should be outlawed. The whole banking system is against the interest of the people. And, you know, we need something completely different than what exists right now. We need to get rid of the finance system as it presently exists.
Thank you, Richard. We'll see you Monday night.
Thank you.
We'll take a short music break. Up next, Jocelyn Beretta, Program Director of Global Exchange.
This is PRN.FM,
PRN.FM,
the number one station for progressive minds.
Progressive minds.
Hi, it's me, John Mueller, host of The Expat Files, broadcasting twice a week from somewhere deep down in the heart of Latin America. The Expat Files is a show that explains what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. You can catch The Expat Files on Sundays at 11 a.m. and Fridays at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and of course in the archives. And don't forget, we'd like you to rate the show in iTunes. So whether you're interested in jumping off the first world treadmill or are just curious about Latin America, take it from me, a guy who's been down here 20 plus years. The Expat Files is tailor-made for you. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm the host of All Together Now, a program about recent discoveries that human life is far more dynamically interrelated than modern society's thought. I hope you'll join me and my guests for All Together Now on Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. If you can't catch the live broadcast, it's available in the archives at PRN.FM. If you like All Together Now, please rate it at iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of A Bowl of Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Tune in as I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to A Bowl of Soul in the archives. If you like A Bowl of Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on A Bowl of Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa.
Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we want you to come
with us.
I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo.
We hope you'll join us in our new time slot for our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com. Mondays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 a.m. Pacific Time.
Sometimes a fever's not a bad thing.
Dreaming is really important to our health.
Laughter's the best medicine.
We should use our common sense.
If you miss our live show, you can always catch the archives on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com.
And also, if you like our show, please rate us on iTunes.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Joshua Beretta is the program director of Global Exchange Fair Trade Short Stores. Jocelyn began her time with Global Exchange in 2003 as an intern with the Economic Justice Campaign, working with Alila Salzar to target large-scale producers of Levi Strauss and the settlement of the Saipan lawsuit. She also continues to work in 2005 at San Francisco Global Exchange Fair Trade Stores, and she is a buyer and a manager now of the whole operation. And she will be speaking at the Green Festival this weekend, so we want to hear a little bit about that. But, Jocelyn, welcome, and tell us a little bit about what you do at Global Exchange.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on this morning. I work with Global Exchange. We're a membership-based nonprofit international human rights organization, and I've been with the organization for about 7 years. We work to ensure people power over corporate power, and we do this through a number of campaigns. We have a community rights campaign, which fights to recognize the rights of community members and the rights of nature over corporate rights. We also have a really strong elect democracy campaign, which has been really active through this election cycle and continues to stay active to ensure that private sector money stay out of our democratic system. We also have a long history of working for peace and justice internationally. We currently have a human rights campaign that's focused in Mexico, and we ran everyone went across the United States together with the folks from Mexico, the caravan across the United States against the drug war in Mexico. What I'm most actively involved in is building positive alternatives. This is what we're doing with the Green Festival, what we do with reality tours. We run tours all over the world, most popularly to Cuba, to educate people around the world and lead delegations of interested travelers around the world. What I work in is in fair trade, and it's about building an alternative economy. An alternative to free trade. And what we believe fair trade to be is an approach to business, to development that's based on dialogue, transparency, and respect, that seeks to create greater equity in the international trading system. And I work in the stores. I've been in the stores for 7 years. Global Exchange Fair Trade stores are in San Francisco, Berkeley, Washington, D.C., and Arlington, Virginia. We've been open for 20 years. So we are a leader in the fair trade movement. And we really believe that the stores are a place for everyone to take direct action every day towards responsible consumption, the celebration of craftsmanship, the enforcement of workers' rights, and the empowerment of artisan communities. We work with a wide network of small fair trade businesses and with artisans from over 40 countries around the world to bring fair trade product to the market. When you come into our stores, every product carries a story of preserving culture, of supporting community, and of sustaining the planet. a perfect example of product you can find. We have messenger bags, wallets, and little pouches that are made of the inner tubes from recycled big rig tires in El Salvador. The tires are gathered in dumpsters from auto body shops, and they've been used and patched and reused and patched and finally thrown away, where they're gathered, cleaned, cut, and turned into a product that is no longer in the landfill and will last you forever.
So Jocelyn, I think, excuse me, one of the issues that we have, I think, around production and consumption is that the longer the chains become between who produces the things that we buy and consume and us as the consumers of those things, the more distant those chains are, both geographically but also kind of conceptually, the less connected we are ethically and morally. And it strikes me, as you're talking about, for instance, that every product in the global exchange fair trade store has a story, and that what you're talking about is in some sense trying to close that distance, to shorten that distance between the producer and the consumer. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. The supply chain is short and completely transparent. And that's the only way that we as consumers can really respect and represent and support communities around the world. Well, the work that we do at the stores, we consider at the end of that short supply chain, it's very important that we play a strong role in running really strong stores, so that we can represent the artisan to the public, so we can connect you with the artisan. There's really very, very few people between that retail store and the artisan.
Now, Jocelyn, you're part of this weekend's festival, the San Francisco Green Festival, which is at the SF Concourse at 635 8th Street in San Francisco. It's all day Saturday and Sunday. And this is where local people come to connect with ideas about the next green steps in their lives. And so there's exhibitors, speakers, workshops and films, cooking demonstrations, kids' activities. It sounds like a fun event. So when are you speaking, and what is the Global Exchange doing there?
Well, the Green Festival is a project of Green America and Global Exchange, and it's in its 10th year. It's in 5 cities across the nation, and we're going to be here in San Francisco, the birthplace of Green Festival, with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. The aisles get so packed that you can hardly get through. And Global Exchange has a booth there. You can stop by and ask about all the different campaigns that I've talked about today. You can get directly in touch with our fair trade stores there. We're a membership-based organization, so come down, become a member. And I'll be speaking at the Fair Trade Pavilion at 4:30 on Sunday, together with a panel of other folks who have started their own fair trade businesses. I'll be speaking on really the nuts and bolts of running a fair trade business, to get everyone engaged and empowered to start their own fair trade business and to support and to shop fair trade.
And that's an interesting idea. Starting fair trade businesses, that's actually happening now, even though we're in a perhaps somewhat sour economy. Is this an area where there's potential maybe for sustainable growth then?
Absolutely. I talk to people every day who want information about how to start a fair trade business. They're small scale. They're local. Actually, I have a perfect quote from the artisans that we work with in Guatemala. I was just working with them a couple of weeks ago, and the woman was describing how important it is during these times for the Guatemalan community, which is experiencing the same hardships that we are, of course, the world economy, that we keep small scale, fair trade, transparent business strong. She let me know that every purchase that we make with her, every purchase that we make here in the United States, affects not only her and her family, but her local community, because then they are able to actually make purchases for local produce, for local handmade goods in their small town. So it is about keeping this small scale people-to-people commerce and ties going during this time so we can all sustain our communities and families.
Is this a global movement? I mean, well, we see a transformation to fair change economy really that benefits the people at the bottom?
Absolutely. It's a global economy, and it's really about, you know, fair trade is about restructuring the economy and restructuring the way we think about what we buy and creating activists and direct action every day in every one of us. It's where we put our dollars and demands that we can make every day about making sure that our power as consumers here in the United States, recognizing that they affect families, that they affect children's opportunities to go to school, all around the world. And it's once you start asking questions and making choices about your purchases, you see that you have direct impact.
Joshua Beretta is the program director of Global Exchange Fair Trade Stores, and you're going to be speaking or being totally involved, it sounds like, in the San Francisco Green Festival this weekend, which will be great to have you involved. And we thank you for coming in, and it's great to see you.
Thank you. See you at Green Festival.
Okay. We'll take a short music break.
Listening to radio, listener-supported KPFA radio. This is the Morning Mix Project Censored Show. Our next guest is Brian DeSager. He is the Archives Director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. And next week, beginning Tuesday morning, the 13th, will be the National Fund Drive for the Pacifica Radio Archives, running through Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Brian, welcome to the Morning Mix Project Censored Show.
Great. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be part of the show.
Thank you so much. So first, tell us a little bit about what all is included in these Pacifica Radio Archives.
Well, we have 55,000 reel-to-reel tape masters that go back to 1949, the first year that KPFA was on the air. And that has sort of been amassed, and our sort of job is to digitize it, get them off reel-to-reel onto a digital format so they can be preserved, but also to make them accessible to the widest range of the public as possible, through academia, through records, through metadata, all that. So it's a very expensive, time-consuming process of preservation. So what's in it is really the last half of the 20th century as told by the progressive liberal left, the poets, the voice of the voiceless, that which we hear all there on Project Censored. In fact, I was going down my list of things will be included in our premium gifts, and there's a lot of stuff that had been censored from, banned books, censored things that still can't be aired on the public radio because of FCC rules, things like that. So it's really exciting.
Well, so one of the ways that the archives get talked about is as a way that history comes alive. In our Censored 2013 book this year, in the Project Censored International section, we talk about the concept of shifting baselines and how if we don't understand and remember the past, we lack a real basis for making sense and making good choices in the present. And so these archives are such an incredible and important resource in terms of avoiding this notion of a shifting baseline syndrome, where we don't really know where we stood 10, 15, 30, 40 years ago, and therefore we don't really know where we are now. So in addition to folks like Bob Dylan, James Baldwin, Gore Vidal, I think one of the highlights is a 1974 broadcast of Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's classic. Can you say some about that?
Yeah, we've actually found that in sort of this idea of bringing classic literature to a new premium, the new gift is a dozen classic pieces of literature as read on Pacifica Radio or performed or adapted for radio. And Anna Karenina was read in its entirety by over 100 celebrity actors from Hollywood and New York, and it was produced here at KPFK in Los Angeles. But I don't know if it was ever broadcast on the other stations, so WBAI in New York or KPFA. There's no record right now that it was ever broadcast over there. So we've actually digitized all of it, and the first page is read by Henry Fonda. The last page is read by Jason Robards. In between is like Patty Duke and Samantha Eggar. And there's also KPFK regular programmers like Uncle Ruthie and Mike Hodel. So it's sort of a mix of a collaboration between Hollywood and, you know, Pacifica Radio, and it's read beautifully. So we're restoring it, mastering it, and making it available along with books like War and Peace, 1984, Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, read by Lawrence Fishburne and Alfre Woodard and Roscoe Lee Brown. We have the Alexandria Quartet, read by a bunch of celebs. And then there's other things like Beethoven's His Spiritual Development, which was a book from 1927, which was read, but also they infused music, so it was like a radio event. So we've got literature coming out our ears here in the archives, and we're really excited to share it.
One of the archives that you informed us about is Ray Bradbury, and he passed away this year, and our Censored 2013 book is dedicated to him as a champion of the freedom to think, feel, and express, and the responsibility to remember. Here's a short clip of Ray Bradbury from 1973, I believe.
I remember 30 years ago being on a bus going to New York City when we were worried about the sound barrier. We were never going to break through the sound barrier. And if we did, we'd go mad. Remember that? Yeah. Or it would shake our bones apart and our marrow would come out and clot around our brain. You know, something horrible would happen. Our wives would go mad on Earth, you know. The same moment we broke the sound barrier and all our children would run amok in the streets. But it's so recent, isn't it? And we forget to turn back to those years. I remember 22 years ago going to New York City, and I went to a party one night, and I was introduced in a disparate group of people. They split into two halves. In one room, there were a bunch of writers and reporters. In the other room was a bunch of dancers from the New York City Ballet. Very strange evening. And they found out what I did for a living. And when they found out I wrote science fiction, they called me Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon for the rest of that night, huh? Well, we've all had to put up with that sort of thing in our lifetimes. And I got a list of these people. And if I ever meet them, zing, boy, are they going to get it, huh? Because I was right and they were wrong, right? And you were right and everyone else was wrong. Isn't that our history? And we share this common thing of being despised and looked down upon by everyone in our whole society. And we are a small band of people here tonight who had the dream and have lived to see it begin to come true. And that's why you've asked me here, because I dream well, I imagine well, I fantasize well, and I can help you in the years ahead, because you're in the hands of NASA. And I've been there too. And I've had those long groaning lunches and in which they promise to lie down for me and they never do. So we have to stay in touch with each other in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Because we are all writing the same book together. We're all creating the same masterpiece together. Now, today and yesterday and tomorrow, you will imagine that you are active about the planet Mars. That's not really what you're doing. That's a step on the way to what you're finally doing and the activity that we all share together. And what we're all doing together is saving mankind and creating him in the universe for the next 2 billion years. And Mars is simply a step to that. So I try to remind people when I see them that's really what we're up to. But we wish to survive, and the reason we wish to survive is we love the gift of life. No matter how much we may pretend to be atheists or agnostics or any other label you want to put on yourself, the fact is you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. I don't believe 9 out of 10 of you here tonight if you didn't like being alive. That's the real secret.
That's Ray Bradbury from 1973 addressing an audience of scientists investigating the possibility of Mars exploration. And we're all writing the same book together, perhaps an apt phrase not only for the exploration of space, but also for what we do here at Pacifica Radio. We're all writing the same book together. Brian DeShazer.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that was at the International Colloquium on Mars in Los Angeles, December 1973. And what a great way to remember Ray Bradbury, who passed this last year, in preserving his voice, you know, his laugh. I love his laugh. I love his humor and his wisdom. And on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 13th and 14th, when we bring the Archives Campus Campaign to Pacifica Radio, you'll be able to hear Michio Kaku on Explorations do a tribute to Ray Bradbury, and Rachel Carson, it's the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring. We'll also be remembering Adrian Rich. We'll also be remembering, not remembering, but we'll be listening to Bob Dylan, some of the earliest tapes of Bob Dylan on Pacific Radio in 1962. So we'll be welcoming, you know, Mitch Jezerich, Sasha Lilly, and C.S. Soong, hosting some hours. Robert Scheer at Truth Dig will be with us, and also giving the listeners the opportunity to, you know, get their little own encyclopedia of Pacifica and sponsor a school. Like, and that's really the cool thing about the campus campaign. You get to name a school, and the archives take the onus to send the recordings to the library. And we've already sponsored over 2,500 schools over the past 5 years of these two-day drives.
Well, so, Brian, we're out.
So grateful.
We're out of time right now. We'll be hearing more from you next week during the fun drive on Tuesday and Wednesday on all the major Pacifica stations across the country to support this 55,000 archive library and get that available to the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Look at PacificaRadioArchives.org for more info.
Okay. We want a couple quick announcements. The Wall Street Conspiracy movie will be at the Grand Lake Theater Monday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m. This is a benefit for KPFA and Project Censored. We really hope to see lots of you out there. Thank you to Anthony Fest and Rod Creel for helping us produce the show today.